With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, Western Growers calls for action on the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. We'll have that story. But we start today with Brian German.
We're joined by Brian Little today, Director of Employment Policy for California Farm Bureau, to talk about the indoor heat illness standard from the Cal OSHA Standards Board. And now last week there was a meeting about it, which included quite a bit of commotion, but eventual approval of the rule. And so, Brian, what took place there and why is it leaving this standard a little bit up in the air now?
The Department of Finance, at the last minute, withdrew their approval of the standardized regulatory impact analysis for the proposed indoor heat illness standard that the Cal OSHA Standards Board had intended to consider and approve last Thursday. So the result of that is, at least initially, the Standards Board was not even going to consider it. Then a few things happened. We had this protest. We had a lot of other things happen in the meantime. And the agency, the Standards Board, eventually decided to go ahead and vote for the proposed standard. But the problem with that is that they do not have the necessary regulatory procedure approvals to be able to approve that regulation. And I believe that means that their action is not valid. But nobody knows that for certain right now. The bottom line is that the agency has until the end of this week to approve the regulation they proposed a year ago this month. Otherwise, they have to start the clock over again. And they have a number of options. They could, perhaps next month, come back and repropose this as an emergency regulation, which would mean they wouldn't require a standard regulatory impact analysis to be able to pass it. I think they might have difficulty justifying that it's actually an emergency, since they've been working on it for 6 years, or 7 years. The other option they could do would be to come back and do something much more limited in scope that would be focused on workplaces with really easily identifiable hazards related to indoor heat, like intermodal warehouses and heat-generating manufacturing activities. But they have not wanted to do that up to this point. The other thing that could happen is that the legislature could pick up the regulation that the agency was not able to pass last week and pass it as a law like they did with the workplace violence standard. So it's really hard to know what's going to happen now and which direction the agency is going to go, how long it might take, and exactly what it is they're going to wind up doing. And I don't really know what to tell indoor employers to do at this point. And of course, for agriculture, the problem is some indoor employers, but the bigger problem, I think, are employers where you have employees who move between indoor employment and outdoor employment throughout the course of the day. And how do you reconcile the different requirements of the indoor standard that the agency considered but couldn't approve last week and the long-standing outdoor standard that we're pretty accustomed to, and we know how to implement it, and we've been pretty successful with implementing it. But how do you shoehorn this new indoor standard down onto it for employees who come and go, who do things like drive tractors and pick up trucks and work in three-sided packing sheds with equipment that can't be left outdoors, and just all those problems that go with that? As of today, I don't really know what to tell those employers to do, because we don't know what the agency might come up with next.
So at this point, because of the amount of variables and maybe some questions regarding the legitimacy of how this all took place, it's more of a stay tuned to what might be the next step at this point.
Yeah. I kind of feel today like the best recommendation I could give to an employer would be to go to a novelty shop and buy a magic eight ball, you know, and just pick it up periodically and see what it says, you know, because I don't think anybody knows right now what the heck's going on and what the agency's going to do.
Yeah, and we'll be sure to stay tuned to the next step in this fairly atypical process now and try to get that information out as it becomes available. Again, Brian Little, Director of Employment Policy for California Farm Bureau, filling us in on the indoor heat illness standard. Brian, thanks as always for the insight.
No problem at all.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the bridge accident in Baltimore underscores the fragile nature of the supply chain. Rusty Halverson has this story.
Logistics companies up and down the East Coast were scrambling on Tuesday, relaying messages back and forth to clients on the status of their imports and exports after the Port of Baltimore was shut down in response to the collapse of the city's Francis Scott Key Bridge. The Port of Baltimore is not a significant port region for soybeans and grain, but it is a leading port for the broader economy. Mike Steenhook, executive director of the Soy Transportation Coalition, says the latest numbers from USDA show that 350,000 metric tons of soybeans were exported via container from the Port of Baltimore in 2023.
That contrasts to the Mississippi Gulf region, which is our number one export region, where you're looking at 35.4 million metric tons of soybeans. So, you know, roughly 100 times more than what you'll see out of the Port of Baltimore. But, you know, that being said, there's a number of you know, components to the ag supply chain, including farm machinery that's imported and exported through the Port of Baltimore. And a number of other agricultural products as well. So while it's not a major launching point for soybeans and grain onto the international marketplace, it is clearly a significant port to the broader economy. It's the number one port region for, you know, the import and the export of automobiles and light trucks. And so it's just all part of this, you know, bigger, you know, challenge and story that we've experienced over the last several years where, you know, our supply chains have encountered a lot of stress.
Steenhook says it underscores the reality that ports can be vulnerable.
Yeah, you know, it's all kind of reinforces the fact that, you know, these links in our supply chain are really critical. And if something goes wrong, it can have a real profound impact on the broader economy.
Steenhook says it goes back to the cardinal rule of supply chains. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
So that's one of the things that is increasingly a point of emphasis for, you know, the Soy Transportation Coalition and a variety of other organizations and industries, that how can you diversify your supply chain so that when something does go awry, and we're continuing to see that occur, how resilient are you? How disruptive are those events going to be? And they always will be disruptive when you have something like this occur. But then the question is, how consequential is it? How fatal is it to you? And if the more you can spread your risk and your products across multiple supply chains and modes of transportation, you're just better positioned for success.
Mike Steenhook of the Soy Transportation Coalition. I'm Rusty Halverson.
During a visit to an Iowa school, the Secretary of Agriculture talked about a new program to boost child nutrition in the summer when schools are not in session and not providing school meals. Gary Crawford has more.
The most nutritious meal that youngsters receive outside the home is at the school.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack visiting a school this week in Clear Lake, Iowa, a school which has won awards for its school meal programs. But what happens to students across the country in the summertime? Vilsack says that's when the new summer food program will kick in.
This is a program that will provide the parents of students who are free and reduced lunch an additional $40 a month for 3 months, or $120 per child, during the summer months to be able to supplement the family's ability to buy food. The teachers and professionals here know that if youngsters can maintain good nutrition throughout the entire year, they come back to the school for the new school year ready to learn.
So far, 37 states have signed up for the program. Vilsack said he hopes the remaining 13 will also sign up. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, a look at USDA's most recent cattle on feed report. USDA livestock analyst Mike McConnell shares more.
The USDA, in its March cattle on feed report, reported that there was 11.8 million head of cattle on March 1st in feedlots over 1,000 head. That's 1% higher than a year ago. And during the month of February, there was 1.89 million cattle placed. That's 10% higher than a year ago. And there were 1.79 million head of cattle marketed from feedlots over 1,000 head. And that was 3% higher than a year ago.
Placements were the highest for February since the series began in 1996. Net placements were 1.83 million head. During February, placements of cattle and calves weighing less than 600 pounds were 360,000 head. 600 to 699 pounds were 330,000 head. 700 to 799 pounds were 515,000 head. 800 to 899 pounds were 485,000 head. 900 to 999 pounds were 1,550 head. And 1,000 pounds and greater were 50,000 head. Marketings of fed cattle during February totaled 1.79 million head, 3% above 2023. In other livestock news, cattle prices continue to climb. There's no sign of the market cooling. USDA livestock analyst Mike McConnell shares more.
So for the month of February, the Oklahoma City 750-day 100-pound price that we track here at the USDA, that averaged about $241 per hundredweight. By comparison, the same month a year ago would have been $184 per hundredweight. So I mean, we're talking about over a 30% increase year over year. Those price increases we've seen steadily over the course of the past 12 months. We really saw the prices start to ramp up in the second and third quarters of last year. But nonetheless, it just reflects the fact that the price of feeder cattle has increased pretty dramatically over the past year.
In other livestock news,
what is the status of USDA's efforts to expand food processing capacity in this country?
There are four aspects of our initiative in processing.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling a House Appropriations Subcommittee about some of the various programs. First, there's the Processing Expansion Grant Program, and on that score,
there's another round of processing expansion grants that will be issued by the foundation that has the resources in the making the decision-making. You'll probably see those in the next couple of months. Secondly, there is a relending program to create an opportunity for additional credit for those who want to expand or create processing.
And there are so-called readiness grants.
We did a number of readiness grants where we enabled existing facilities to expand their markets beyond state borders.
And Vilsack said there are other grant programs geared to creation or expansion of small processing operations.
So over the next 6 months, you're going to continue to see an expansion of processing.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I'm Will Jordan for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's latest ambient air quality standard for fine particulate matter leaves some significant questions for California. President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, highlighted the latest PM2.5 standards and how California aims to fit into them.
Bottom line is we haven't met the existing standard, so we're going through some iterations of revising the plan and some of the rules here to get to the current standard. 35 micrograms on a 24-hour standard and 12 micrograms on an annual average. And then most recently, EPA dramatically dropped the annual average standard from 12 micrograms down to 9. That's a huge difference. I've been asking people, some of the experts, do we even think there's a possibility we can even achieve 9 micrograms? And right now, people are scratching their head. They don't know the answer to that. Certainly, you're going to see probably a move to end combustion, if that wasn't a movement already, for climate change or for ozone. Because when we're talking about the standard we're talking about is PM2.5. So that's that ultra-fine particulate. It's not really dust. It's smoke, soot, and what they call secondary particulates, ammonium nitrate, ammonium sulfate, which again, primarily comes from combustion. So you're going to see a big push on that. And again, we were already doing it.
Several food items saw a price decline in February. USDA economist Megan Schweitzer highlights some of the food numbers from the Consumer Price Index report.
We saw declines across meats, poultry, fish, and dairy. So for poultry, prices declined by 1.3% last month. Pork declined by 0.6%, other meats declined by 0.3%, fish and seafood by 0.7%, dairy by 0.6%, fresh fruits also declined by 0.8%. And then food at home or grocery prices increased by 0.1%, and they were 1% higher than they were in February of 2023. Food away from home or restaurant prices also rose by 0.1%, and food away from home prices were 4.5% higher than this time last year. And prices for all food, both food at home and food away from home, rose by 0.1% and were 2.2% higher than a year ago.
The Cooperative Lending Association AgWest Farm Credit is currently accepting applications for the New Producer Grant Program. The program's designed to help motivated producers get started in agriculture through grants of $15,000 in startup funds to successful applicants to support their agricultural ventures. Other benefits of the grant include educational support and mentoring. Eligibility criteria includes being a full or part-time agriculturalist with 2 years or less of operational experience, or have plans to start an operation within 2 years of the grant application date, and have an operation located within AgWest Farm Credit's territory. Applicants will need to prepare a business plan, cash flow budget, application, and a one-page essay describing how the grant will help achieve operational goals. Applications are due by May 31st, and more information on the grant program is available at agwestfc.com. Farmers and ranchers still have time to apply for conservation assistance from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Last week, USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service extended the deadline for the Conservation Stewardship Program in California, with nearly $20 million in funding available. The new deadline to apply is Friday, April 26th. CSP supports farmers and ranchers in addressing resource concerns and achieving stewardship goals by integrating conservation activities into their operation. USDA's increased the minimum annual payment for new and renewed contracts for individuals participating in the program from $1,500 to $4,000. Producers receive payments for activities like cover crops and pest management, promoting soil health and water quality protection. Some of the benefits that CSP participants have seen include enhanced resiliency to weather and market volatility and a decreased need for agricultural inputs. In response to the Agricultural Labor Working Group's report on the farm labor crisis, Western Growers President and CEO Dave Puglia urged Congress to consider the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. The report highlights the challenges of labor shortages and rising wage costs affecting domestic produce production and leading to farm consolidation. In a letter to the Ag Labor Working Group co-chairs, Puglia emphasized the benefits of the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, including potential savings for H-2A employers and its bipartisan support. Despite its imperfections, the legislation has received widespread industry and labor union backing. Puglia lamented the Senate's failure to take up the legislation after it passed the House twice with bipartisan support. He expressed hope that the Ag Labor Working Group's efforts would inspire bipartisan collaboration in Congress and encourage action on addressing the farm labor crisis. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
California is seeing some higher pork prices after the implementation of Prop 12. That's coming up on This End of Hours. Prop 12 is already raising the price of pork in California. With the proposition in effect for just over 6 months, pork sales have dropped across the state. That's from data compiled by the USDA's Office of the Chief Economist. The OCE found prices for pork products affected by Prop 12, including loins, ribs, and bellies, have averaged 20% higher in California since before July 1st of 2023, when the initiative was partially implemented. Loin prices average 41% higher than before Prop 12 implementation. Pork not covered by the initiative has not significantly increased. The data also shows that California's share of fresh pork consumption has significantly declined. The Economist found that the price premium end users for Prop 12 compliant pork compared with non-compliant products at the wholesale level was 22% higher on average, with compliant loins and bellies 30% higher. If you are thinking about taking up vegetable gardening for the first time, Gary Crawford has some expert advice for you on this edition of Agriculture USA.
Here's a song from that classic old musical, Fantastics, with a couple of gardeners who sing.
Life is very if it's very vegetarian. A man who plants a garden is a very happy man.
or woman or child. We drag that old song out every so often when we see a resurgence of interest in gardening, and that's what's been happening over the last couple of years. If you're thinking about getting into gardening for the first time, stay tuned. We have some expert advice that could save you a lot of time, trouble, and frustration. It's coming up on the advice on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. Last spring, there was a huge uptick in sales of seeds and plants and garden supplies to first-time gardeners. This spring, that's sort of settled down, but still, lots of people for the first time ever are saying,
inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this
Well, it might take a little more than that, but if you are trying your hand at growing some vegetables for the first time, we do have some expert advice, which is get some expert advice.
Every state in the United States has a wonderful extension service, and my first bit of advice would be tell people to use it.
Particularly to find out what plants are the best for your area and when to plant them. This from Dennis Patton. He's a Kansas State University extension garden expert. He told us,
the internet is full of scary advice.
Scary.
Yeah, but if you go to your USDA Extension Service in your state or your county, you're going to get good research base, not some wise tale or home remedy on gardening. So that's the first place to start, is with good, solid research-based information through your land grant extension.
Now, Dennis Patton's advice for newbies?
Start simple. Start small. You know, you're not trying to hoard food for the winter. You're just trying to supplement your diet during the summer.
Some of us get a little overly enthused, end up with far more work than we planned on, plus more produce than we know what to do with. And along that same start simple theme, Dennis says maybe we shouldn't start off clearing a special section of the yard for the garden or building raised beds and all of that. Instead, Dennis says just incorporate your vegetable plants
into your traditional landscape. So instead of putting in a thick pack of petunias in the spring, put in some green beans. Or take advantage of a spot where an overgrown shrub was. Take it out and put your tomato plants in there. And so do this kind of idea of incorporating the vegetables into your existing space until you know whether or not you're going to love it.
Also, remember that like any hobby that we take up for the first time, it can take more time than we might think. And with many of us now back at the workplace, we may not have the time to work a big garden. So just planting some vegetables in the normal landscape is a good idea.
The other thing that's really been popular, and I've gotten more questions on this year, is growing vegetables in containers on your decks, patios, and you can certainly grow a lot of veggies in various containers.
Okay, now earlier you heard Dennis mention tomatoes, so let's roll out this timeless 1983 song from Guy Clark.
Homegrown tomatoes, what'll life be without homegrown tomatoes?
Well, I have never had much luck with homegrown tomatoes.
Tomatoes, they're not that difficult to grow once you just give them some basic requirements or basic needs.
First, Dennis, what's the biggest mistake that people make when trying to grow tomatoes?
The biggest mistake people make is planting them too early when the soils are still too cold and there's a chance of a frost, and then the plant just sets there and it kind of gets stunted.
Dennis, he mentioned providing our tomatoes with their basic needs. One of those needs is at least 6 hours a day of direct sun.
And a lot of neighborhoods that have mature trees or people that live in ever-increasing, you know, townhomes, apartments, sometimes struggle to find that sunlight. Second is they're going to need good drainage. So we try to avoid spots that tend to hold water, stay wet for a longer period after rain. And then we also like to have those vegetable gardens somewhat near to a water source, because in most parts of our country, we're going to have to do some supplemental watering during the summer months.
And that brings up the third mistake many of us make with our
homegrown tomatoes.
And that is overwatering in combination with having the plants in soils or pots that don't drain well. Most experts say only water when the soil feels dry below the 1-inch level. But watering advice varies depending on where you live, what variety you're trying to grow, what kind of soil you're using. But for best results, Dennis Patton again says check with your local Ag Extension Service. They've got the information to help you with those homegrown tomatoes. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
As American consumers' demand for organic food products has grown over time, so has available products, some of which originates from foreign markets, Rod Bain reports.
Organic food products continue to grow in popularity with consumers. If recent USDA data on sale trends are any indication, despite year-over-year sales declining over the last 2 years of record, organic food retail sales from 2020 to 2022 are above levels prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. And more retail organic sales are taking place in traditional grocery and club stores and supermarkets. So what are consumers purchasing in the way of organic products? USDA research economist Sharon Skorbiansky at this year's Ag Outlook Forum said one way to look at it is what types of organic foods are being imported into our country.
The value fell for the highest value commodities, so that is blueberries, avocados, soybean, and coffee. But the value did increase for some other commodities like olive oil and bananas.
In fact, imports of organic goods have increased annually since 2015. Particularly in the area of tracked imports.
The value of tracked imports has been trending upward, and it increased in 2023 as well. But 60% of the value of these imports can be attributed to new harmonized tariff schedule codes, or HTS codes. It is a really important distinction between actual imports and tracked imports.
As the U.S. uses HTC codes to set tariff rates and statistical categories for imports.
There are now 125 HTS codes for organic, with 45 new codes added in 2023.
Products represented by new import codes range from organic dates and red lentils to maple syrup and tart cherry juice concentrate.
It doesn't mean that these products in organic form were imported prior to 2023. It's just that they were recorded under a more general HTS category. So we just have no means for comparison what that value was prior to 2023.
U.S. consumers continue to purchase fruits and vegetables, followed by eggs, then bread, among the top selections of organic products by category. And in case you are wondering what U.S. organic products are among the top exports to markets globally,
apples, lettuce, and spinach, these are the three most exported organic commodities.
With most of those purchased by Canada and Mexico. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has today's interview.
We're joined this morning by President and CEO of AgSafe, Teresa Keene, and Anna Genasi with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau to talk about an event last week in Modesto to highlight some of the hard work that farm workers put in. And so, Teresa, let's start with some background on what this was and how it came about.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. And so the Farm Worker of the Year program came about 4 years ago, and it was a collaboration between Stanislaus County Farm Bureau, Modesto Rotary Club, AgSafe, and the Modesto Rotary Foundation. And we were looking to highlight essential workers. And the Rotary Club really wanted to do something different and decided that farm workers are an important part of our community and agriculture. And so we reached out to Stanislaus County Farm Bureau and wanted to see if they were interested. And they have been a fantastic partner. And so we've been able to put together this program because of this collaboration.
Nice. So a few different entities coming together here to celebrate and honor farm workers in the area. And now, Anna, how does the award process work here, and who is recognized at the event?
So we have been really blessed now for 4 years having great nominees come forward. So we ask that ag employers, you know, nominate folks on their team that they think would be a good fit for this award. This year, we had a great set of nominees come through. Our winner, and I even hate to use that word because they all have really great stories, but the one that stood out, I guess, was Salvador Anya with Stewart and Jasper. He has worked for S&J for 55 years. He started in high school as a laborer picking up pruning brush. and has now, he's leading crews that are doing, you know, pesticide and fertilizer application. He's doing all of the irrigation work. In fact, one of the fun little stories that came out of his interview was his record keeping on irrigation is what the irrigation districts refer to for historical documentation, because Salvador keeps such meticulous notes on what he does every day. And I have to say, Brian, when he was asked to come up on stage to receive his award, and I'll let Teresa talk about the amazing sponsorship that happens, because we're able to do cash awards for our winners, he was like visibly choked up and just so appreciative of being acknowledged.
Wow, the fact that his records have been picked up, it definitely seems reasonable for him to win an award such as this. if your ideas and your way of doing things are picked up on a larger scale, definitely worth celebrating there. And now, Teresa, you'd noted that there's several different partners involved in this. And so let's get a little bit more into how all this just comes together.
So the Modesto Rotary Club has really embraced this awards program, and it's one of the highlights of the year for them now. And so we're already starting to plan for next year. But they came together and provided over $10,000 for us to use for this awards program. So we gave out more than $7,000 in cash awards, along with some beautiful plaques. And we also had elected officials there and representatives. And so they all received certificates of recognition. And it was just a really great time to celebrate our community, the work that our farm workers do for our industry. And it was just a beautiful blend between the ag industry and business leaders, and just coming together to celebrate the bounty that California Ag produces.
And that particular aspect seems really important, bringing together urban and agricultural perspectives to really shine a light on the hard work that goes into farming. And so looking at some of the pictures here, it looks like it was well attended with quite a mix of folks, just all coming together to honor those workers and maybe inform those that might not know just how much hard work goes into farming.
Absolutely. And I was also going to just add, along with this program, the focus is on ag for this meeting. And we invited Joe Dolboski with Dolboski Farms out of Fireball to come and be our speaker. And so he got a chance to speak about, you know, farm workers and public policy and, you know, sometimes the unintended consequences of public policy and how it impacts our farm worker community. And so really encouraging our audience to get to know our farmers, get to know our farm workers and the issues that are important to them and how they can also advocate on their behalf.
Yeah, I would say in the, you know, obviously Farm Bureau plays in the advocacy space. And I just really appreciated Joe's comment when he was speaking to the group about before, you know, rules and regulations are passed that impact farm workers, folks need to ask farm workers what they actually want. I think there's this gap in communication between what people think is good for our farming community and what really is good for our farming community. And the most notable issue right now is the change to the Ag Workday. And as a result, now farm workers are actually taking home less money. And so I just, you know, Joe's note to the community group about like, hey, come and talk to us. And that's always my plea from a Farm Bureau perspective. Like if you see something on the ballot that impacts agriculture, give Farm Bureau a call and get our perspective on it. I do want to make sure, though, that we give a shout out to the other folks that were recognized. While Salvador was our platinum winner, Ishmael Garcia with Heinrich Farms, has been with them for decades, has become their right-hand man, always positive. In fact, the Heinrichs, the employer, talked about Ishmael being just such a bright, positive attitude and singing regularly. So he brings a smile to his coworkers. And then in third place was German Fertita. He's with a dairy. His story, you know, has grown in responsibilities, has been with the family farm for decades. And then our honorable mention group was Nathan White with Serpa Farming, Antonio Machuca with Rod Gambini Farming, and then Keaton Machado with Machado Farms. And so all these folks work here in Stanislaus County for agricultural employers. And because of the great sponsorship that Teresa talked about, each person walked away with obviously a, you know, a plaque of recognition, but also a monetary check just to say, hey, we appreciate you. And it's just such a fun surprise to see these guys come up on stage and shake hands and get their plaque. And then they don't know about the cash award until it happens.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thank you, Brian. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. USDA recently released a study on how expiring and expired federal income and estate tax provisions could possibly impact farms and farm households. Rod Bain reports.
Tax legislation in some cases have components that are temporary. These types of provisions are sunsetting, being expiring after a certain period of time. How might this impact farmers and farm families? USDA research economist Tia McDonald starts by explaining.
A lot of the provisions that we run into as just regular taxpayers are going to affect farm households as well, but there's a number that are specific to business owners. And a number of these provisions are temporary.
She says the sunsetting of temporary provisions in federal income tax and federal estate tax laws could impact a farmer's income and a farmer's ability to pass along the farm to the next generation. In turn, this possibly affects the long-term financial well-being of an ag operation. McDonald is among researchers studying those impacts of sunsetting provisions in tax legislation to ag producers and their families. Included are provisions that have already expired and some scheduled for expiration in 2025. Findings in the study indicate
that would increase tax liabilities for farm households by $8.9 billion across all farm households. And the impact is really going to vary by farm size and then by provision.
She adds the largest impact in tax liability comes from changes in a group of related provisions
that include changes to income tax rates and tax brackets and a change to the standard deduction. That's going to have the biggest impact on tax liabilities for all but the biggest farm households. The biggest farm households are going to be most impacted by expiration of the qualified business income deduction. That deduction is equal to 20% of business income. Any farm household with positive business income are potentially going to be impacted by the expiration of that provision.
Another sunsetting set of tax provisions with possible impacts to farm households increases in child tax credits.
That affects a fair number of farm households. About 36% of farm households receive a child tax credit. So as that expires, the benefits definitely decrease for farm households.
I'm Rod Bain reporting.
Calling it an historic day, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was at Great River Organic Milling in Fountain City, Wisconsin, to announce the first ever commercially available product as a result of the USDA Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities. Columbia Grain International, owner of the Great River facility, along with AgriCapture, joined forces to introduce a long grain rice grown using climate smart practices. Vilsack says this is exactly what the partnership was designed to do.
The ability to receive an incentive payment to embrace climate smart practices, the ability of folks to create a market opportunity that creates a premium product and a premium price for the farmer, and for consumers to have the assurance that what they're using their consuming dollar for is supporting climate smart rice production with technology that is reducing methane, eliminating a significant amount of water used in the process, which has immediate impacts on climate. And as we deal with water scarce challenges around the world, will certainly lead to American leadership in rice production.
The rice is grown on 30,000 acres in Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and uses a combination of flooding fields and then letting them dry out, thus reducing methane and water usage by 50%, along with increasing carbon capture. The rice is available through Enrich Foods via Amazon. The company is planning on having the rice available at grocery stores by the end of the year. That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.